Do we have an ethics system in our state government that reflects the expectations of Alaskans, or does it need work? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. A highly popular governor has left office saying to stay in place would be just to encourage an expensive spectacle. What does the proliferation of ethics complaints against her really mean? Our number, 1-800-478-8255, toll-free, 478-TALK, email talk at aprn.org. What ethics are we entitled to expect is the subject on Talk of Alaska statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
So here we sit with Steve Offrecht, Professor of Public Administration, University of Alaska, Anchorage. Steve, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Good morning.
Good morning indeed. You also have a blog. What do I know? We've had you on about that, I think.
Yeah, it was probably about a year ago.
Yeah. And I think the subject was blogging the trials.
Yes, that was it.
And why would you go? You're a professor. Why did you go to trials?
Well, I'm a professor emeritus, for one, so I have a lot more time than I did.
That's a good explanation right there.
Okay. Well, ethics is something I taught public administration and still occasionally teach a class. And I was, I'm interested in the area of ethics, and I have written on the subject, not too much, but enough to get into trouble. And the other thing was that the first defendant was a former student of mine, and I wanted to see what was happening in court firsthand and not just take it from the newspaper, though I have to say in hindsight, Lisa Diemer at the Daily News did a very good job of covering the trial.
Yeah, actually, I think the coverage ended up being fairly even-handed, as it turned out, and accurate. But, you know, here we are in a situation where we have an ethics law in the state of Alaska, and for the most part, this is never going to get to a court. The adjudication is done by an ethics board. The question, however, arises, can it be misused? In other words, is it so strict that it just simply generates, people see the possibility of getting some leverage and a political advantage and hence use it to generate complaints? Because we've had a lot of complaints.
Well, Steve, you know, a law is just a tool that human beings have created, just like a car or a gun or a hammer or whatever. And all of those tools can be misused by someone who takes the power that's in those and uses them in a way that was not intended probably by the inventor. And so we do have a problem.
Do you think? Do you think we should have a strict confidentiality for filers of complaints? Might that do it to try and remove that publicity element?
Well, I sat for several years in on the Municipal Board of Ethics Commission, the Ethics Board for the Municipality of Anchorage, while they were rewriting the Municipal Code. And that issue came up. And it's in there sort of that you're not supposed to, if you file a complaint, you're not supposed to say anything. But the issue of the conflict between free speech and so forth is also there. I mean, there are times when confidentiality, you know, can be applied, but there's also, you know, if you have confidentiality there, then the public never knows necessarily that something has been filed or what was found. And so you could hide wrongdoings as well as you could misuse it the other way as well.
Exactly.
And so those are some of the problems. Steve, I'd like to step back here and talk about, you know, why we need ethics and what this is all about. Because I see, you know, I'm particularly looking here not at personal ethics, but ethics in terms of public officials. I taught public administrators who are, you know, career people who work for government agencies or nonprofit agencies, as well as elected officials. And it, you know, there's an inherent conflict of interest for any employee in any organization because you, you have personal obligations to your family, to your church, if that's of interest to you, I mean, if that's important to you, to your friends, and to your interests, whatever they are. And then you have professional responsibilities, which in a public organization or to the public, to the organization, to doing a good job and things like that. And ideally, your personal obligations and your public obligations are going to overlap so that you're working in an organization that pays you a salary that allows you to meet your personal obligations to your family, to live at a reasonable level, certainly one that's appropriate with the status of your job and your education and so forth. And also the organization should be doing things that you want to do, that you think are important. So a doctor working in a hospital, a doctor wants to save lives and stuff like that. There's an overlap. But sometimes people get in organizations because they just needed a job and they really don't care what the organization does and they have no interest and they're not vested in it. Or they get the job because they need the money or it has a good pension attached to it and they really don't have an interest in it. And there are some cases where people get the job because it's got power over something and they want to take advantage of that. So there's a lot of reasons why people get in there. But there's an inherent conflict. And I see most of the stuff that's dealing with conflict of interest and with ethics talks about conflict of interest as the problem. But I saw when we were working on the ethics code at the municipality that if you tell people, particularly politicians, that conflict of interest, if you have a conflict of interest, you're unethical, then you're telling every politician in Alaska that they're unethical because everyone has potentially a conflict of interest. Even the best employee whose values overlap with the organization is 80%, there's always the potential that something's going to change, that someone in the family's going to get sick and he's going to be distracted from his job, or that the organization's going to have budget issues and some people need to be cut. And then suddenly there's a conflict. You know, who's my loyalty to this place that might cut my job or to my family? And so it's always potentially there. And I think that what I've been writing about is that the conflict of interest itself is not the problem. It's the effects of the conflict of interest. And there's two big ones. One is undue gain. That is, you use your office to get things that are not due to you. And you know, I mean, the due gain is your salary and all the benefits that, you know, contractually you have in exchange for doing certain work. And undue gain is everything else. It's an extra payment to hurry up on giving me a permit. It's an extra, it's a trip to Disney World with your family to see some playground equipment that the city might want to buy.
I love that.
You know, it's anything that you're not supposed to get, that's not in your contract for what you get, that someone else is offering you. It's even, you know, on a very small scale, it's even a fruit basket that the bank sends to the finance department at Christmas.
So in a sense, we almost need a preventive ethics board. Almost need somebody to say, you know, they offered me this trip, we need the playground equipment, but I'm not sure about this. It's almost like you need somebody to go to.
If the trip has to be part of it, if you have to go look at the factory, then it should have been in the request for proposal initially, or the city should pay for it, or
that's sounding suspiciously like an ideal world, though, Steve.
Well, you know, we're always trying to get there, right? We have laws against murder and theft. You know, even though we know those aren't going to end, we still have laws against those things.
Yeah. So you say, look at the outcome,
the consequences.
Look so much into the what goes into it, because we're always going to have conflict situations.
I mean, the first one is undue gain, and the second one is improper influence, and that is when you make. I mean, proper influence is when you make a decision as a public official. You have standards to make that decision by, whether it's the law, even the Constitution, rules and regulations, standard operating procedures, and even professional standards. Say if you're an engineer, you have professional standards for how to build things. So, you know, those are the things that you should be making those decisions by. Now, some of the improper influences would be, well, my uncle has a piece of property, and if we build the road near the property, the value of his property is going to go up. Or I'm going to, you know, I'm going to make this decision depending on who slips some money in an envelope
to me. Well, that would
me.
Be pretty obvious now, wouldn't
well,
it?
Well, I mean, for instance, at the municipality, there was a construction company. I mean, and this is 25 years ago. Construction company that regularly bought coffee and donuts on, you know, Monday mornings to the permit department. And, and of course, you know, when they came in to get a permit and they needed it quickly, you know, they're going to get a little more attention than someone that doesn't do that on a regular basis.
You know the guy. He's
yeah,
been
absolutely.
In your office every week.
Absolutely. So, you know, those are some of the kinds of issues that come up. They seem innocuous. And you know, even in the three state political trials, you know, the issue was that, you know, we didn't do anything that we wouldn't have done anyway.
Exactly.
I mean, we got this money, but, you know, we voted the way we would have voted and so forth. But, you know, it to me, it all goes back. There was no quid pro quo, you know, but it all goes back to the godfather when he's at his daughter's wedding and he says to someone, you know, someday I may call upon you to do me a favor. But until that day, consider this a gift on the day of my daughter's wedding. So there's always, it's always out there. There's an obligation that someone may call in the future. I mean, certainly Bill Allen was not palling around with Pete Cott and Vic Coring. Just, I mean, if they hadn't been in the legislature, he would not have been their best friend. And that's the real issue. And because that's the undue gain. You get this benefit because of your position.
Excellent. A very nice analysis. Well, Steve Offrecht is our guest. He's Professor Emeritus of Public Administration, University of Alaska, Anchorage. He's published on this issue of ethics, trying to boil down the basic principles. And I believe you have two, right? What so far that we've had is the undue gain.
Well, two consequences, undue gain and improper influence, I think are the issues that we should be looking at. And when we worked on the Municipal Code of Ethics, one of the things we tried to do, because the municipal code essentially was a list of things you shouldn't do. You know, you shouldn't take bribes,
right.
You shouldn't, you know.
No, shall not. There's an interesting boil-down sheet that you can get from the state's webpage that is like that, too. Just,
I mean, it's simply, don't do that. I mean, if someone just read it, you would think all of the state employees or all the municipal employees were crooks, and you had to make this list of things
you
shouldn't
tell
do.
Tell them they're complete idiots. They should know this already.
Right. And the other problem with the list is, if what you did isn't explicitly on the list, then it's okay.
Yeah, right. That's the other problem I was going to bring up.
That's the other problem. And so we, to a certain extent on the municipal level, got them to write also an affirmative list. These are things that are expected of public employees, that you're going to be doing things in the best interest of the public, that you're going to be trying to save money, trying to do things in the least cost way and things like that. And we also identified explicitly undue gain and improper influence. To say, you know, and the attorneys sort of argued and said, you know, that's too broad. And I'm saying, but, you know, you don't have a law that says you can't shoot somebody, you can't stick them with an ice pick, you can't run them over. You just say you can't murder somebody, you know, and you don't detail every possible way you can murder. And in this case, we shouldn't be detailing every possible way you could be unethical, but we should set the broad principles, and then we can look at it and say, did you get undue gain here? I mean, did you get more than what you're contracted to get?
The subject is ethics complaints and when are they frivolous, and it's Talk of Alaska. The telephone number, 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, and you can send an email that I can see here at talk@aprn.org. Let's go to Gakona, where David joins the program. David, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hello there. Hey, my concern, and The real thing is, why was Sarah Palin in all the things she done for Alaska, and then why was she targeted? The thing is, that one woman from, I don't know where she's from, I just don't read her, what you call,
her blog?
Ethics complaint. Hmm. Why does it keep going on and on and on? Why don't the ethics committee or whatever they are, if they can, or what's the purpose in this ethics committee from the university? What good is it doing? What it did was throw our really Sarah Palin off the books, because she can't keep fighting that court. The court, I think myself, is they're pretty well, it's a everyday thing for her when she was in office.
Well, there have been a lot of them. It's absolutely true, David. Let me see what Steve Offrecht has to say about that. A number of ethics complaints, dismissed. Does that necessarily mean that they had no merit?
Well, I think it's a good question, and I think it's one that a lot of people are asking. And, you know, essentially, there's a process that goes through. And if someone makes a complaint, you have to fill out a form, you have to notarize. And in that form, you have to explicitly identify what law or, you know, was violated, and then you have to identify facts and show why you think, you know, what evidence you have that those facts are true, that shows that this person may have violated the law. And it's similar to someone going to court, where you have a prosecutor saying, you know, here's the law that was violated and here's the evidence. Now, obviously, with going to court, there's a higher level, a higher threshold. But then there's an attorney in the Department of Law who looks at the complaints and says, you know, is this actually a valid complaint? I mean, here's the law and here's the allegations. Yes, if these allegations are proven true, then this would be a violation of this law. And then that's given to the state personnel board, which has nothing to do with the university and has nothing to do with the courts. It's a board that is appointed by the governor. And in this case, I think Murkowski had appointed the three members and Sarah Palin had reappointed one or two of them. So that was the group that looked at these complaints. And in some cases, they did find some violations. And I think a citizen who feels the need to make sure that an elected official is accountable doesn't have a whole lot of options for doing that. And one of these options is this ethical complaint process.
Right. Well, do you think we need some kind of threshold that maybe comes at a less expensive point to just go through the form and say, this doesn't match up. You ain't got a case here. I mean, in criminal law matters, you often will have some evidence, but it doesn't ever stack up. It's a prosecutor who has to decide if it stacks up. I mean, maybe these complaints don't quite stack up, and yet they still have to go through this whole process.
Well, you know, I also think that when one person is filing a complaint, there's probably other people out there that have similar issues. And in some ways, like a court, it's in the governor's favor, if there is no evidence there, for it to be reviewed and to be found that there's nothing there, because it says publicly, we have looked at these allegations and there's nothing there. And in terms of the cost, you know, it's not really that big a deal to look at, you know, is there a state law listed here, and are these facts relevant to that law? I was the grievance coordinator for a while for the faculty union, And, you know, frequently people would come in and complain to me and say, you know, I have a grievance, I want to file this grievance, and we'd have to look at it and say, well, where's the violation? I mean, where in the contract or where in the university policies, you know, what was violated? I mean, you can't just grieve because someone's grumpy.
Yeah.
And so you'd have to do that. And I say, you don't really have a grievance because there's no rule or regulation that you can point to that was violated.
Right. Well, are you saying that that's quite different, however, somebody's alleging some misconduct on the part of a high government official?
Well, and that's the same thing. Uh-huh. I mean, you know, you have to say, here's the law. And I allege that, you know, here are the facts. Person did these things that violated the law. So it has to go to a committee that then's going to look at it and say, did that really happen? Now, in terms of the expense, you know, the expense of doing the initial screening is not that great. And as I understand it, the personnel board, they're volunteers. So, I mean, they do have to perhaps have some attorneys and so forth. But, you know, I mean, the documentation that I saw said that there wasn't that much money spent, certainly not nearly as much as the governor alleged, and that most of it was spent on the Trooper Gate stuff, which the legislators were going to look at, and the governor herself insisted that the Personnel Review Board should look at it.
So I guess in response to my caller, what I'm getting out of you is the way you would look at it, this shouldn't have been a big enough deal to make a governor resign.
You know, I think there's always things going on, and there's uh-huh. always people complaining. I mean, in terms of how they complained here was more public, but I suspect that the governor made more out of this than actually it was or needed to be.
Okay. Let's go to Pam, joins the program from Anchorage.
Good morning, Steve and Steve. My question, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about the ethics of withholding information. And in other words, and this happens a lot in rural Alaska as well, that especially in areas where you have family members or, you know, in-laws and so forth running a lot of the organizations, that the information that should be public, even just ordinary information like who owns which company or information about who you talk to about moving senior services away from the city, isn't discussed and isn't even acknowledged. And as a consequence, people don't know what's going on. And the news media, which is pretty limited, will also not cover that information, will not ask the questions.
Okay, so where are you going with that?
Well, it seems to me it is unethical not to reveal that you want to take an action that would in some way involve working with your brother-in-law, for example. But it doesn't involve any monetary gain to anyone. It may mean a power gain in some way, but it also, if anyone decides to raise a question about, no one will investigate. There's no way to find out further information.
Nothing is said.
Years later.
Oh, I see. So, and this will often happen in smaller municipalities, I guess. Saying that the problem really is that nothing is said, that a disclosure ought to be required, or, you know,
well,
it's hard to know how to get at it.
About the ethics of transparency.
Yeah.
Well.
Yeah. And a recent case may be the one out in with another public radio station where a lot of people just are unwilling to discuss certain topics, and then how do you approach those topics?
Yeah, I guess so.
Probably not on a blog.
No, not on a blog, no.
You know, one of the things that I would like to see happen in the discussion of what's been going on in the state and the discussion of ethics is that we pull back and talk about ethics in a more general sense. Because if you talk about particular incidents, you suddenly divide into I'm a Sarah fan and I'm a Sarah opponent. And we don't look at the facts and we don't look at the concepts and the principles that we're trying to uphold, but we look at whether our our side is going to win or our side is going to lose. And I think it's important for us to have a larger context of ethics and how do you get good ethics. And in one of the articles that, or one of the book chapter I've written that, you know, follows up in the, what I've been talking about the inherent conflict, I also talk about that there's an inherent conflict between, say, the rule of law, which would be our obligation to the organization, our professional obligation, and personal loyalty. You know, we have our families, we have our friends, and when there's a conflict between helping our friend and following the rule of law, you know, some people go for the friend over the rule of law. And I think some of that has to do with how you grew up and the values. I mean, you know, I don't think rule of law is anything. If you ask people, what are the five most important values in your life? Relatively few people will say rule of law. Though, you know, the whole United States is based on this contract called the Constitution, which says we're going to follow these laws.
Yeah.
And but it's not something that we think about in that sense too often. And, you know, as I look through all this stuff, you know, some of the questions that come up and different, I mean, in some societies where the government is not so good, and I know people complain about the government in the United States, but it's compared to other places, the government in the United States is often relatively fair and you have opportunities to challenge things. Are some questions like, you know, can administrators meet their basic needs, that, you know, live a lifestyle that's consistent with the social expectations for a person of that status, from the compensation they get from their job? If they can't, they're susceptible to bribes and to corruption because they don't have enough money from their
jobs. I knew you were going to get down to that sooner or later, Steve.
To which?
you're a professor of public administration, and I think you've also worked for the union, in the union.
I mean, look,
and so obviously you feel public servants don't get paid enough.
No, I didn't say that. I said if.
Okay.
In some cases they do, in other cases they don't.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think some public employees in Alaska get paid very well, compared to what they could get if they had an equivalent non-government job, and other people get paid low compared to what they could get in a private job. I mean, if professionals like attorneys and engineers and accountants.
Right. So we'll just go to the principle then, which is?
Just the principle that you need to be paid enough, you know, for the kind of job you have and what's expected of someone
right
at that level. Another thing is, are there conflicts between the social norms and the rule of law? Are there things that you're supposed
to have a law?
Yeah.
You know, are you supposed to do things like take care of your relatives? There's some of the immigrant communities that live in Anchorage have really strong family ties. And if somebody dies back home, everybody goes and leaves and goes to the funeral and does stuff. And the people here have obligations to send money to their relatives that aren't necessarily understood by the kid's teacher when that kid leaves for 3 weeks in the middle of the semester. So we have these conflicts between the cultural norms.
So then, you know, getting back to the point that Pam was bringing up, you can see errors of omission taking place then in order to avert a conflict.
Absolutely.
between personal or family cultural values and what the law spells out.
Right. And now to the nitty-gritty stuff is, you know, what is the likelihood of getting caught breaking the law? And if we look at the Alaska State Legislature, you know, for 20 years, the likelihood was pretty low, so that it became the custom. And things became the norm in Juneau that then some people got caught on.
Okay, so what we may have with the large number of ethics complaints against the governor we have new Executive Ethics Act, we have people trying to use it, and the process just has to slosh around until it reaches an equilibrium.
I mean, ethics is not a black and white, and there's a gray area in between, and that gray area shifts as culture changes. I remember when Spiro Agnew was convicted, he made some comment about the reason he was convicted was because of post-Watergate morality. That is, the rules had changed, and a sitting governor in Maryland was no longer allowed to take bribes in his office. Before that, that was, you know, business as usual. And so the rules have changed, and I think some of the things that, I think it was David who called earlier.
Yeah.
Some of the complaints against the governor seem frivolous to a lot of people because they're things that have happened on, you know, forever. But there's a new act, and people are saying, you know, there's the law, and then there's how detailed do you want to be on all the technique. You know, if you don't sign one of the forms correctly, you know, what's the consequence of that? But now people are saying, this is what the law says. We want it enforced. Otherwise, you know, why do we have the law?
The good point. Steve Offrecht, Professor Emeritus, Public Administration, our guest. We're talking about ethics complaints. What is a frivolous ethics complaint? As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from BP Alaska. BP, where training Alaska's future workforce is a priority.
So we're a young state. We have an ethics law. Are we misusing it? Or is there a period of adjustment to make this new ethics law work for us? And do we even know what we really want and what is appropriate in the way of ethics? And then it goes and changes. Steve Offrecht is our guest. He's Professor of Public Administration Emeritus, University of Alaska, Anchorage. And of course, you know, there are events in the news that kind of bring the subject very much to the fore right now, but we're trying to step back a little bit and engage some of the principles of civic life here as well. Caroline in Anchorage, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Yes, good morning, Steve, and good morning, Professor Offrecht. I had wanted to mention a couple of, or maybe even three things. Number one, Steve, I'm sure you as a press person would be concerned about the use of BlackBerries to hide government work, to keep things from the public. That would be clearly a violation of laws that were in place before the new Ethics Act.
Yeah, that's fairly a straightforward case right there, yes.
Yeah, and once you pick up a smelly thing like that, you start wondering what else is out there. I've been up here a little over 40 years, so yes, I've seen a lot of corruption, and I came from the rural South where it was, I thought, worse. The lack of trust, you know, crying about the ethics violations, and I guess I'm showing my opinion by using that word, crying, and then coming out and saying that the idea of resigning had been months in the thinking process, that to me was a bit of a quandary there. What was the reason? And some of these things do appear to have been expensive, but according to Paul Jenkins in one of his statements on the Michael Carey's show, the governor insisted that everything go through the Department of Law, which, of course, would increase the cost. And finally, you know, this whole thing of the personnel board makes me wonder if that isn't, when the governor can appoint so many of the people on that, if that's almost not like getting off on a technicality. And Steve, Professor Alfrecht, I really appreciate all the work you've done in this, because the history of corruption, if you ever want some things I turned over in the years I was traveling throughout Alaska, I would be happy to pass them on, because it is astounding. We've had the cry from people, well, you know, if we just paid our legislators more, they wouldn't be likely to do illegal things. Well, anyone that knew George Holman and his record in Bethel, I don't think there was any amount of money that would have kept him from doing what he did. So I really want to thank you for the program and just applaud all the things you're doing. And are we as a nation almost turning into a banana republic with all the corruption that we're seeing?
Let's hope not, Caroline.
Thank you.
Well, with global warming, we may have bananas up here soon.
Cash crop. Yeah, you want to take a shot at that?
Yeah, because I think, again, it goes back to some of these issues I was starting to talk about in terms of the questions that you want to ask. I mean, I skipped a question there. One is, you know, are there options to meet one's personal needs illegally in a society? And then what is how likely are you to be caught? And then what are the consequences if you're caught? You know, is it worth it to break the law and to be punished, because the benefits of the corruption are so much greater than the punishment?
And so, that can be, there's a difficult equation with sometimes what kind of story will you tell the public that they will swallow? It was a similar situation.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so it leads then to the strategies for coming up with some kind of an ethics code, you know, that has a chance of working. And again, you know, every law is an attempt to, you know, correct people's not so good intentions. And you know, you can't change those with the law. You can just put in more consequences. But I think some of the things have to do with society as a large, as you'll see. I mean, one, organizations have to provide enough compensation and free time for employees to meet their basic needs. I mean, you know, mothers and fathers have to be around to take care of their kids appropriately, as well as have enough money to take care of their needs. You know, I think healthcare is one of the issues here as well. A lot of people get jobs so they can get the healthcare, even if they're not interested in what the organization is doing. And so that already sets up a conflict. Public officials should not be able to meet their needs through illegal channels. I mean, there should be big obstacles to that. And public officials pursuing illegal channels should have a high probability of being caught. And some of the ways that you do that is one that two callers have already asked about, which is transparency. The more that things are visible and everyone can see how the decision was made, who paid money to whom, and so forth, that makes it less likely. And certainly we heard in the trials of Cott and Coring and Anderson, well, particularly Cott and Coring, that Bill Allen said, well, we made sure that we weren't violating the law. We couldn't give them the money this way because it would be a violation of the law. We need to have independent watchdogs. The press and certainly the written press in Alaska is suffering economically and does not have as many reporters covering things. I guess the Anchorage Daily News did not have a reporter in Juneau in the last session. Is that correct?
Off and on.
Off and on, right.
Yeah. And don't you feel, in a sense, I mean, when you were blogging the trial and there was press coverage there, but nonetheless, don't you feel in a sense that bloggers are trying to plug a hole in the dike because the press is falling down on the job sometimes?
I think even if you have a really good newspaper that's got a full staff that's paid well, they're going to print certain stories.
Yeah.
And everything that's happening in Anchorage is not going to get there. And so bloggers are everybody, I mean, potentially. And when they go to, you know, their child's musical at the school, they can post about that. That's an event that may have more significance than the opening of a new play in the Performing Arts Center, because it's local people performing. So it's, you know, there's a lot that can be filled in by everybody. And, you know, with Google, you can find the events that you want to know about.
So do you think bloggers are that watchdog you're talking about?
In some cases, they are.
And how about people that file ethics complaints?
Absolutely. I mean, that's a watchdog kind of function.
Okay, so we have the ombudsman's from your office. Your equation is that, you know, so what if it costs some money? Isn't that part of the process? Maybe that's part of what we need to pay for that.
Well, I mean, having a police force costs money too, but we decide it's worth it to prevent crime.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly, you know, the judge at the three trials said, you know, on one level, this has happened. But because these are public officials who had our trust and had a higher obligation than ordinary citizens to honor the public trust, it was a more severe violation. I mean, that was the reasoning that he used there.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, we do need to pay for the watchdog. I mean, it's like saying, you know, we have to stop regulating foodborne diseases, you know.
That didn't work
because
out too
it costs a lot of money to do all that. But, you know, there's the costs of not doing it are even greater.
All right. Let's do another call here from Anchorage. Heather, welcome to Talk of Alaska.
Hi, Steve and Steve.
Hi,
Heather.
This is a subject very close to my heart and one in which I've had a good deal of experience. Professor Steve, you're wonderfully academic, but I know you've been...
I promised Steve I would be.
but I know you've been part of a real-life experience, and that's really what a lot of the callers have alluded to, but I mostly have a local view of this, not so much a statewide view, but my famous or rather infamous comment that's been quoted multiple times, if you've never had a conflict of interest in Anchorage, Alaska, you've never done a damn thing. And the result is declare, shut up, and leave the room. And to me, that is the simplest ethics comment that you can make. Just declare it, shut up, and leave the room. The problem is...
Well, you know, Heather, what happened in the legislature is routinely you got a situation where lawmakers would say, I don't want to vote on this. I've got a conflict. And their colleagues would say, no, you will vote on this.
Yes, and I have seen exactly the same thing happen in Anchorage on the assembly and on the school board. And you know what? The individual is the person who's responsible. They should understand there is a bright white line there that you do not cross. And I have had an assembly vote that I had to vote, and I said flat no. I know I have a conflict of interest. So what we've got here is the conflict of the group. And what it comes out looking to, in my opinion, to the public, is that you vote that I don't have a conflict this time, and then I'll vote that you don't have a conflict next time. It's called, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. And that, to me, leads to unbelievable level of cynicism and distrust in government. You've got to know. You've got to know as an individual, these are things you do not do. And if you can't see that bright white line, you better take a class from Steve, you better learn about that line, or you better get out of office.
Thank you, Heather.
You're welcome.
From Joette Storm at the Public Relations Society of America, the ethics director sends me an email saying, when a person campaigns on a platform of upholding ethical standards, as Sarah Palin did, she created an expectation. Consequently, the public held her to those standards. Apparently, her actions caused some to be disappointed and file complaints. I think that shows there's a demand for politicians to be ethical. How those complaints are handled creates its own ethical issue. State employees have certain obligations with regard to what information is considered public and when it may be released. A positive result of this situation is an increased interest in learning about and discussing codes of conduct. Here's her pitch. I personally have been facilitating and discussions on ethics for professional organizations and businesses in recent months. The format has individuals consider situations that pose an ethical dilemma, which they analyze for the values at stake and the principles of a professional code. You mentioned the engineer's code. I often introduce that as well as the public relations code. And indeed, you know, we're a young state, Steve Offrecht, and I'm thinking some of these things we still are just working out.
Well, there's old states that are still working them out, too.
yeah, there sure are. I know. I've seen it personally.
You know, I mean, one of the things when I first came to Alaska a little over 30 years ago was that there weren't that many old folks, I mean, old folks meaning in their 50s and 60s, who had the senior level positions. And there were a lot of young people in the legislature and in the state government and in the local government who were good and gung-ho, but they didn't have people with a lot of experience who could say, Steve, let me tell you about what happened 25 years ago and why you shouldn't do it this way. We had a lot of people who were learning on the job. They were smart, some of them, but they didn't have the wisdom and they didn't have older mentors who could move them in the right direction. I think we're getting some more of those, but I'm, you know, and certainly we have people who have seen a lot of wrongdoings and made mistakes and recognized those mistakes. And, you know, I think maybe that will help. And I think that goes to what you're talking about, a young state.
Let's go to Jack, joins the program from Nome. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Jack.
Thank you. I have two points that I'd like to air. One is I understand that Bill Allen had been convicted of a crime and then had his sentencing delayed until he could testify in various ethics problems. And it seems to me the implication is that if he testifies the way they want him to, he'll get a lenient sentence, and if he doesn't, he'll get a harsh sentence. So that seems to be, I don't know, prosecutorial misconduct or
Well, can I comment on that? He wasn't actually convicted, but he signed an agreement with them and admitted that he had done things. And you're right, there is a real conflict there in terms of they made not quite promises, because the judge makes the absolute final decision, but the prosecutors can recommend to the judge that he not be sentenced more than this, and that his kids would not be indicted. And so, yes, as he's going along, how he testifies and how he acts as a witness is going to affect what the prosecutors write to the judge at sentencing.
Well, Jack, of course, if you flip it around, if the sentencing is done, all incentive is removed, right?
Right.
Yeah. So, Jack, I want to get back to your...
It seems to me that that's coercing testimony.
But all right.
That's my first point, and I understand your point. The other one is, when you get ethics complaints against somebody, do you examine the complainer? In other words, if this person has a political bone to chew, or dislikes that the person they're complaining against, or is of the opposite political persuasion and is complaining just to get him out of office, or is a chronic complainer, do you examine that?
Well, I don't. You know, I'm not in the position to be taking in complaints, but I would say who is making the complaint should be irrelevant. It should be, does the complaint have merit? Because if someone's a chronic complainer but has a legitimate complaint, we shouldn't dismiss the complaint because of who's making the complaint.
Yeah. If you want to hang in there, Jack, we got to take a break, and Talk of Alaska will return.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Tel Alaska, a telecommunications company proud to support public broadcasting, sharing the spirit of communications across the Great Land. Voice data and Wi-Fi technologies at Tel Alaska. On the web at telalaska.com. Go deep inside Alaska, where the unparalleled meets the unexpected. Fairbanks emanates a quality of light, energy, and warmth found nowhere else on Earth. It's the unexpected Alaska. Fairbanks, located right in your own backyard, is full of activities from the mild to the wild. Experience summer's land of the midnight sun in Fairbanks. Information about attractions, travel, accommodations, and more online at explorefairbanks.com. This message sponsored by the Fairbanks Convention and Visitors Bureau.
It's Talk of Alaska, and we're talking about ethics and our expectations, and do we even know what those expectations are, and how Can the system work better? Steve Offrecht, Professor Emeritus of Public Administration, is with us. Jack is on the phone. Jack is raising the issue of chronic complainers. How far do you take that, Steve Offrecht? I mean, you said, well, look, if the complaint has merit, the complainer is somewhat irrelevant. But there have been instances where the legal system has been used as a means of harassment.
Anything can be abused. And I think the issue is to look at the complaint and look at the evidence. And you have to make a decision that way. I mean, if someone, if a prostitute comes in and says she was raped, do you say, wait a minute, prostitutes can't be raped, you have no case?
I see your point. Jack?
Well, if all politicians are corrupt, then any complaint against them is valid.
Well, they have to have done what it is you're complaining about. I don't think anyone said.
If you see somebody proposed for political office or in a political office, and then you suddenly see batteries of investigative reporters and political hacks talking to their neighbors and digging into every aspect of their lives, and you know for a fact that these people are trying to get them out of office, and that's why they were complaining. I think that is as valid to look at as the complaint itself.
Well, I do think there does tend to be a kind of a flocking behavior when somebody smells blood. I mean, I think that does happen, and the media is not exempt from that.
The point is, you said when you know for a fact, and it's really hard to know what people's intentions are. I know that someone on the other political side from me who's doing that is just harassing my candidate. But the person on my side who's doing that is legitimately going after somebody. And I think that's how we all feel. And I think it really, there's the issue of, one of the things that I thought about talking about here, because it really underlies everything we do, is the notion of stories that people carry around in their heads. And so we read something about someone in the newspaper and we get a few facts and we take those facts and we construct a whole story about who that person is and what their intentions are. And often we're totally wrong. Some of it has to do with the way that even the news media creates a story. They have a story in mind before they even go and talk to the person. And they may write the article based on the story that they came with rather than the story of...
Or they have an agenda and they take certain facts to fit that agenda and ignore others that don't fit.
Absolutely. But we all have that. We all have that. Some of us are better...
It doesn't make it right.
Some of us are better at filtering than other people are, and some people's intentions are better than other people's intentions. But knowing who those people are is hard to do, and I see myself having to question myself when I make judgments like that about other people.
Jack, yeah, I think that's the key, is asking yourself the questions. Jack, that is a very thoughtful comments. Thank you so much for your call from Nome.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jack.
Cha-Lin weighs in and says, Palin pushed the new ethics laws into being, never considering that her own humanity would not be taken into account anymore when she did not allow for the humanity of others. It's like her relationship with the press. She loved them. When they loved her, when they asked questions, they became unethical. So it's kind of that same thing about stories we tell ourselves, in a sense. We do tend to tell stories to ourselves.
Well, and we have stories that are in our heads that we're not even aware of, that we grew up with. I think there's a story behind the word quitter. It was interesting. One of the articles in the paper yesterday, I think it was Greg Erickson, said Sarah Palin was not a quitter. Well, I mean, she quit her job. So you could logically say she was a quitter. Except that the word quitter has connotations beyond simply being someone who resigned. It has connotations of giving up, of not persevering. And so someone who wants to think well of Sarah Palin will say she's not a quitter, though I have to say the rest of his article did not say particularly good things about her. And people who are against Sarah Palin, you know, will say she's a quitter, because there's a story behind that word. You just have to say that one word, and it packs a lot of meaning beyond just he quit. Well, and I think that's why we should talk about what people do rather than what they are.
Well, Steve, we only got a couple of minutes here, and I would like to get to Mary Jo's call from Anchorage. But first, let me ask you for your shot, because you thought about this in the local government context. What do you think about the tweaks that Governor Parnell would like to have in the Ethics Act to require confidentiality?
You know, I think it has a real conflict with our right to free speech and our right to open government. I think like a trial, you know, the charges before someone are made public. You have the trial in public. Everyone gets to see it. And the trial itself is a way for people to see that something was dealt with fairly or unfairly.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to Mary Jo in Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Mary Jo. You almost have the last word here.
Okay. Yeah. Just a small comment. People sometimes use legal or the law in the same breath as ethics and
good
ethical.
Point.
And certainly we, you know, in many ways they are the same. But I want to point out that they are also very different. They're not synonymous. Sometimes ethics require doing less than one might under the law, or sometimes it requires that we do more than required by the law. That's it. Thanks.
Thank you. That was a great point. And it's, you know, I have a bunch of things that I knew I was never going to get to, and that was one of them, that just because someone's legal, something is legal, doesn't mean it's ethical. And just because you can do something or you have the right to do something doesn't mean that you should.
It seems that we're all just approaching and approximating what our civic consensus is. Do you think where our civic consensus is becoming less or more as we mature as a state? I'm starting to worry that it's actually becoming less.
So I'm not sure that our maturing as a state is the issue. I think it's technologically where we are in the world today that we, you know, when Walter Cronkite was reading the news, we all heard the same stories together. Today, you know, you can read one blog and read about one reality, and if you don't like that reality, you can read another blog and have live in a totally different reality.
Steve, how are we going to carve out any civic common space?
Well, I'll answer that in 2 seconds, right?
Okay. Another show. Talk of Alaska, thank you for listening. Dave Waldron on the controls, BD Trantina on the phones, Pat Yak on production. I'm Steve Heimel.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Alaska Communication Systems. ACS offers high-capacity, high-speed bandwidth for business with speeds up to Gig E, connecting companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.